Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now we're in-depth on belief, doubt, and faith in Hollywood. We seek transcendence through sex, drugs, prayer, poetry, electric guitars, alcohol, pornography, Santa Claus, and the lazy man's form of transcendence, lying. Or so says my next guest. Anything to reach beyond, he adds, because, as his mother said, your life is your life, and we want it to be as big as it can be. Actor Stephen Tobolowsky has been in over 100 movies and 200 television shows, including Mississippi Burning, Groundhog Day, and Glee. But if you're looking for a greasy Hollywood tell-all, you're not really going to find it in his new memoir, My Adventures with God. He does mention Diane Keaton, which made me happy, and there's a fair amount of cocaine, but it isn't that kind of book. Rather, this warm, funny, insightful book follows the arc of the Torah, divided into five sections. In it, Tobolowsky explores faith, the inconsistency of love, doubt, that he says is integral to wisdom. It's like a bad hangover, unpleasant, but proof that you're still alive. Stephen Tobolowsky joins me from San Francisco. Welcome.
Good morning.
Uncertainty and doubt, especially self-doubt, are easy currency to come by in Hollywood. What very little I know about it. What has being there taught you about doubt and the relationship between doubt and belief?
Well, certainly every project you're ever on is going to be great. And it's going to last forever, and it's going to really change the way people are, and it's going to make a dent in entertainment history. And of course, it almost never does. I remember I was being interviewed for a sitcom I had done. I think it was called Blue Skies. I was about to do a show called The Tom Rhodes Show, Mr. Rhodes. And I was interviewed by CNN, and the interviewer really began great. He said, "How do you feel being on stage 24 where you've experienced so much failure before?" But this is a great way to really warm up the interview. And I said, "Well, how do you describe failure? How would you encounter failure?" Like the two shows I was on this stage, granted, one of them we did 8 shows, one of them we did 9 before we were canceled. But how do you measure success? How do you measure any kind of completion in this sort of business? If we had run 3 seasons and didn't get a 4th, if we had run 4 seasons and never been nominated for an Emmy, anywhere along the way, you could take a look and say we had failed. But let me tell you, in this stage, we heard people laugh. And people laughed, and you could feel the walls shake. And for us, that was success. So in terms of doubt and completion and feeling secure with your ideas, it is a completely sliding scale. You will always find doubt in the greatest successes you have. And in your greatest doubt, you'll also find completion and wisdom.
Do you think you need to have doubt in order to fulfill belief? In other words, are they symbiotic? Do they always need one another?
Hey, doubt comes with the territory. We're born with doubt. I'd like to feel, you know, there's no way anyone can know everything all the time. And so we're always dealing with an incomplete set in our brain, a finite set of what we know. And in that vast, uncharted territory of what we don't know lies that little creature we call doubt. And you could either make that creature your enemy, or you can make that creature your friend. And there are various ways. There are various ways. We all know the ways. Doubt can become our own personal hell and can undermine our confidence. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the jumping off point between what we know and what we want to be is doubt, but it's also the springboard of imagination.
Doubt can be very unattractive.
Oh, it's always unattractive, especially on a first date. I remember on one first date, I had covered every one of my bases. I had brushed my teeth. I had combed my hair back when I had hair. I wore a suit, a 3-piece suit, to look like a banker. And I went out, and while I was driving the girl to the restaurant, I realized I had forgotten to zip up my fly. And at that point, I was filled with doubt. And I was waiting for the first chance at some sort of stoplight to distract her so I could complete my dressing. The thing about doubt is that it opens the door from what we are to what we want to be. And that is where doubt becomes our friend. And that is where I wear it every day, thinking like, what is my next greatest doubt and how can it help me?
I want to talk about something that your friend Dwayne said in regards to Santa Claus. It's always easier to believe in something than it is to, am I saying it right, than it is to say it was never true?
What Dwayne said, it's always easier to want to believe in something than it is to say it never was true.
Explain that
now,
to me.
Now, you must explain to the listeners that Dwayne was not your ordinary guy.
Yeah.
Dwayne was incredibly wise. He was 7 years old, and he was speaking to me at the time in which I was 6 years old, and we were having an in-depth discussion about belief and the crisis of belief.
Mm-hmm. Particularly as it relates to Santa.
Well, particularly as it deals with Santa. But I realized that even at the age of seven, Dwayne so perfectly described the human inclination to want to believe in something, that it's always easier to want to believe in something than it is to actually take the courageous stand and say, you know, maybe what I'm believing in is not true. And there we go to doubt again. There we go to doubt again and to constant understanding of what it is we believe in. I think one of the difficulties in, or at least it wasn't a difficulty, it was a challenge, was in whenever you write a book in which you're talking about how people relate to the invisible in their life, where there is no concrete evidence, when people relate to faith or something they sense is out there like intuition, it's difficult because that arc changes throughout our life. What we are when we're six and seven, like Dwayne and I, very different like I am now in my 60s. What now I'm certain in is completely different. The amazing thing about what Dwayne said is what he said at the age of seven is true throughout all of our lives, that it's always easier to want to grab on and believe in something because we want certainty than it is to say it never was true. And then you cut yourself free and you're floating in that sea of I am lost. And I do have a commandment I make for myself, a saying that I made for myself. And this I write down and I believe it every day of my life. Everything is a prison and everything is a doorway. And I mean everything. So when I find myself in doubt, when I find myself lost, I tell myself, you know, there's a doorway here. You can find it. And you could profit by that doorway. And at the same time, when things are going very well, and, you know, when I'm working and when I'm happy, I say, wait a minute, Stephen, be careful. There's a prison here somewhere, too. You must always be on your guard. You must always be vigilant during good times. And I have found that is a good way, again, is a good way to deal with doubt. Or if you're feeling no doubt and certainty in your life, it's a good way to inject a healthy dose of skepticism in what you're doing.
I was thinking of it more in terms of it's easier for me to believe that, for example, my marriage was good and believe in it than to say that it never was true.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, That's very good. It's easier to believe that I didn't make a huge fool of myself by getting involved in this relationship, that there was some quality to this at the beginning other than just one too many tequilas at the wrong time, introduced in my life at the wrong time that led to this series of situations, than it is to say, that there was value. We always look for value and we always assume that certainty means value. And that's a confusing little set of nouns. But if you think about it, we tend to confuse the idea that we're certain about something with truth. And then reflexively, we say the truth is value. So we connect those two ideas together, that we're certain and therefore it has value in our life. But sometimes the greatest value in our life is the ability to doubt and the ability to question and the ability to think. I think that's what makes us human, and that is what allows us to grow. That's what allows us to evolve, and that's what allows us to become better people. I remember there's a great quote by George Eliot in Middlemarch, and she says, there is so much you could learn when you come in contact with a new person. You could learn to become a better man. And I listen to that, and I think that's absolutely true. You know, in my relationship with my wife, Anne, when I became a father, I meet these people, and it gives me the opportunity to be my better self. And one thing I always say about a prayer, you can take a look at a prayer as being silly or reflexive or whatever, but the idea of a prayer is we are stating the way we wish the world would be. We are able to look at the world at that moment as our better selves.
I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Kerry Miller today, and I'm talking with Stephen Tobolowsky about his new book, My Adventures with God. And as you can hear, it's not really a Hollywood tell-all type of memoir, although he has a great collection of his life stories in here. We're focusing more today on his faith and his Jewish tradition and belief and doubt and the connection between the two, and I'd love to hear from you. Tweet me at Tiffany Hansen with two S's, E-N. How do you see the connection between doubt and belief in your tradition, in your life? Has doubt shown you, as Stephen says, what you want to be? On Twitter at Tiffany Hansen. Stephen, I'd like to talk to you about how this book is laid out. I mentioned at the top of the show that it follows the arc of the Torah. Is that right? How did this all come about?
Well, the premise, when Simon and Schuster asked me, they enjoyed Dangerous Animals Club, which was kind of a collection of true stories from my life that I meant for my children to know about their dad. They said, well, we really enjoy the true story and we really enjoy the humor, but what people are really gravitating to are the spiritual ideas in your stories. Is it possible you could present another collection of stories that's funny, but at the same time is held together with kind of a spiritual strand? And that's when I came up with this conceit. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, and at the time I just did it kind of as a debater to kind of find some sort of skeletal structure to grab onto for this book. But the more I think about it, the truer it is that about everyone I've ever met, their lives fit the template of the Old Testament. We all have a Genesis. These are usually stories we say on a first date with the first glass of Chardonnay about who we are, who our family was, what our aspirations and intentions are. Then we have all gone into slavery, like in the book of Exodus. But instead of building pyramids, we have the slavery of first loves, first miserable jobs and employment or lack of employment. Some people with drugs or alcohol. Some people just staying in graduate school forever. And then, like in the Bible, we break free, but we're still mm-hmm. lost in the desert. Then we have this Leviticus moment in the middle of our life where we stop the wheel of time and we go, just a second, This is what I am. And in my little Leviticus moment, this is when I got married to Anne. This is when I became a father. This is when I returned to Judaism, in a way. Mm-hmm. Then we're all shaped by mortality, like in the book of Numbers, and where we lose parents, friends, loved ones, and we are shaped by that mortality again. And then finally, if we're lucky, we end up in the book of Deuteronomy, where we tell our stories to our children and to others to try to make sense of what this whole journey was about anyway, just like Moses told the story of the Hebrew people to the Hebrew people because they forgot what they were doing because they'd been wandering in the desert for 39 years.
So you have a narrative arc here for how yes. you've laid out the book based on the Old Testament or the Torah, right?
Yes.
you use narrative also throughout the book, but you've talked about it in a way, in a very scientific way that I want to talk about with you also. One of your sons is a scientist, right? Or are both?
Both are.
Well,
one is organic chemist and
right?
the other's a doctor.
Right.
Yeah.
So you talk at length about science in the book, and you point out that our lives are three-dimensional, right? Fourth, if you include time. I'm getting a little into the weeds here. But you assert that there's a fifth dimension that exerts a force on us, which is the narrative. And I want you to explain yourself. How does narrative play out in our lives?
We all assume length, width, and depth. We all assume time, but we don't really think about it that much in our lives unless we're trying to find parking spaces in San Francisco or Los Angeles and put enough money in the meter so we don't get tickets. That's probably the only way we think about that. But the fifth dimension, the dimension of narrative, completely changes our lives as to what story we think we are telling with our life. Do we think we are in the middle of a love story? Or do we think we are in a tale of revenge?
So are this is a narrative we are telling ourselves?
Exactly. Do we think, oh, I'm always going to lose. You know, I'm always one of those people that'll get picked on to a certain point and then I won't get the part. You know, the actors who tell themselves that, oh, well, they won't want me for this. The actors who tell themselves that usually don't get the part because they are living out that narrative. And I believe that we've developed codes for discussing narrative with one another. Like when we see people and we go, so what's going on? We are looking not for raw information. We are listening to what their narrative is. Narrative is raw information that's filtered through a choice. Usually it has a beginning, middle, and an end. I have a friend of mine who's a cinematographer, and he was talking about digital cameras. And now the metal plate in a digital camera captures billions of bits of information which mean nothing to us. It's not like the old days with film where you get an image. It's all of this electrons on a plate. It means nothing until we apply a filter, and then an image begins to emerge depending on how we want to manipulate that filter. And so we have many, many filters that we apply to the bits of information of our life, and that is narrative. It's the way we see our lives. It's the story we tell ourselves.
I would like you to tell the story when you were a little boy of the plane crash.
Ugh.
Yeah. Because well, I have a question I need to ask you about that.
Okay. We like to think of crisis and faith and belief as being a specifically adult occasion, an adult feeling, but it's not true in my life. In my life, I was 10 years old. I was going to Sunday school, and we always listened to my dad always set the radio, even though my mom was driving. So we listened to the grown-up channel that was more news than music. And there was the talk of an airplane crash on the way to Sunday school. And everyone on board the Electra jet, the future of American aviation, was killed. And then the next iteration of the story came, and there was one survivor, a 10-year-old boy. Well, of course, this had great impact on me because I was 10 years old. And from then on, I was no longer looking at the funny papers in the morning news. I would fight my father for the front page to see what was happening with the 10-year-old boy. And the story was the reason why he survived was that he was sitting on the back row of the airplane, which was the safest place to sit. And so as the days went on through the week, it consumed me, the thoughts of the boy and how he would survive now that his parents were killed. When next we went to Sunday school the next week, the story on the radio was that the boy in the back row had lost his fight for life. And they always say his courageous fight for life. I was devastated. And the only thing I could think of, three possible choices. One, there is no God.
Mm-hmm.
Two, there is a God, but he doesn't do a very good job. Or three, there is a God. He may or may not do a very good job, but maybe his job is different from what I ever thought it was. And I was in crisis for a long time, and it probably was responsible for my first falling away from God, the ideas mm-hmm. of God and faith in my life. What was that tragedy that happened to that boy?
What I wanted to ask you is, it seemed to me that when you went to the rabbi, that
yes.
he didn't help you very much. I was kind of angry with him.
Rabbi Klein was my great teacher. And one thing was, I didn't really ask him. Now, again, all these are true stories as far as my memory is, but you're talking about a 10-year-old boy's memory. I did not talk to him about the boy. What I talked to him about, he knew. Rabbi Klein knew as I was leaving temple, I was troubled. And he took me back inside the synagogue, and we sat on the back row of our chapel. And he said, "Stephen, what's wrong?"
Hmm.
And I said, "Why is it that God punished the men who built the Tower of Babel? Why didn't God want men to go to heaven?" And Rabbi Klein explained to me that the story of the Tower of Babel was not about men trying to climb up into the clouds to see God. He said that God creates and man creates. When God creates, there is beauty. When man creates, like in the Tower of Babel, there is confusion. In our lives, we always think we are rebuilding a new Garden of Eden. But what we end up with is another Tower of Babel. And that was the conversation I had mm-hmm. with the rabbi. But I did not share with him about the boy with the back row. But, you know, your question is well taken, because I think, and no one has ever asked me this question before, so thank you for that, is that I think I was embarrassed by my crisis of faith and sharing it with this man that meant so much to me in terms of fostering faith in me from the beginning. I was embarrassed to tell him, "I don't know if I believe in God anymore because of what happened to this boy."
I remember having that very early crisis of faith also. Mine was very driven by, am I going to go to hell if I don't believe in this thing? What does that do for us long term, do you think, in terms
yes.
of coming around to some sort of deeper understanding of faith, God? Does it get us somewhere, do you think?
Yes. Yes. I would say this. And this sounds like gobbledygook. And a lot of times when people talk about God and faith, it always sounds like gobbledygook.
Mm-hmm.
But an important part of faith is loss of faith.
Mm-hmm.
An important part of belief is losing your belief. Why? It creates doubt. It makes you reach beyond yourself, as the first quotation you mentioned in our discussion today about transcendence. It makes us reach beyond what we were certain of. We have experienced hell in that phone call. We've experienced hell in that moment where we have been devastated by what we believed in turned out to be not true. And we immediately fall in hell. And the importance of knowing that that hell exists in our life is it gives us hope that heaven exists too. When we lose our faith, it really argues that there is a faith that exists that we will eventually cling to.
I want to talk to you about grace.
Yes.
Because grace is something, I think, like doubt and belief, is sort of double-sided.
Mm-hmm.
That we often feel we have to come to after going through pain. Or that we have to, you tell a great story that we can't spend a lot of time on about biting through a very difficult period in your life.
Yes.
Which a lot of people, I think, experience, where they have to go through a very difficult period in their life, whatever it may be, a divorce, losing a job, something terrible happens to them, they find ultimate grace at some point where they experience something that they interpret to be grace entering their lives. What is it about that duality of faith that people experience? Why is that, do you think?
Again, I think it would come down to the way you see the narrative of your life. I heard one rabbi explain grace as being dumb luck. It being something fortuitous that happens to you that you did not deserve or that you did not earn by necessarily hard work. And we can assign where that comes from, either from the divine or just the fact that our number came up and we won the lottery that day, the spiritual lottery I'm talking about. I think it depends on the narrative, again, you want to tell with your life. If you feel that there is an overall purpose to what we are doing and that there is a story we're building upon, we can see the good things happen to us as having some meaning beyond what they are. There is a story in the book of the horrible accident I had. And it was hard to see anything good of that when I broke my neck in five places and had the doctor said, a fatal injury. It was very difficult to see the positive in that, except I did read a little line in the Talmud, which helped me with my narrative, that said sometimes when a person has been injured or has an illness or is in despair, it is not a curse, but could be a blessing to help that person see the world with new eyes, to elevate that person to see a different spiritual nature to the world around them. And I was thinking like, well, boy, that would be lucky, wouldn't it? And I'll be damned. It was 3 months later, the event happened to me. I'm in my neck brace, and suddenly an event happened, and it made me see the world with new eyes. And I thought, damn, it's true. And so there was an example of grace. Grace assisted by a faith-driven philosophy from the Talmud. But it is in our life, and I think that there is a value, a specific value of saying like, well, good things happen to me, bad things happen to me. That's one way you could look at your life. But there's another way to look at your life by saying, if I try to do as many of the good things that would be on Santa Claus's naughty and nice list, if I try to tell the truth and not put the stumbling block before the blind and not curse the deaf, if I try to fill my life with these things, more good things will come to me. And when catastrophe comes to me, I will have more tools to find grace in the catastrophe. Everything is a doorway. Everything is a prison. And I mean everything. And grace is part of that.
Stephen Tobolowsky is an actor who's been in over 100 movies and 200 television shows, including Mississippi Burning, Groundhog Day, and Glee. His new memoir is called My Adventures with God.